Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to talk about Sonata, a project that helps you translate all the prompts in your program to whatever language you need to translate them in. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 233, recorded November 21st, 2012. Sonata. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the big shows, the little show, the big shows, the big projects, the little projects, the movers, the shakers, stuff you might never have heard of, stuff you might have heard of every week or every day as you're using it. I don't know where this show is going to fall in, but probably some of you have heard of this project. It's the Sonata Project. But before I talk about the Sonata Project, I'm sorry, Simon Phipps, welcome back to the show.
It's great to see you again, Randall. Hello from darkest Southampton in the south of England, where I'm. There's just me and some sort of bug that I picked up on my trip to Italy last week to free software conference in Bolzano in South Tyrol. And I'm sitting here nursing it and trying to avoid it taking over the planet.
Okay. Well, at least we're only Skyping. We're not. There's no other protocol that actually transmits bugs like that, so we should be okay. And for those who watch, sorry, go ahead.
That's right. I'm assuming that you have an antivirus installed over there anyway, so you'll have no problems from me.
But Linux doesn't need antiviruses, and neither does OS X. Why should I put one in?
Well, you're running Skype. That's software from Microsoft who invented viruses.
Oh, God. Okay, you're right. So those of you watching the video may see that I'm actually in a slightly different location than I've been recently. Last week's show, which unfortunately was canceled at the last minute, was supposed to be my last show at Media Temple. So you won't see the big Media Temple microphone anymore or anything like that. I'm actually starting a new client next week. So I'll tell you more about that once I get on site. I'm actually at the house of Captain Neil, the guy who puts together all those wonderful Insight cruises that I spend 6 or 7 weeks a year on. So he's graciously let me borrow his living room for a little bit of time. I've been busy working on his website for the last few days, so I'm going to get right back to that as soon as we get all done with the taping here. But let's see. So let's talk about today's project. It's Sonata, something like that. We're going to get David Mason on. He's going to talk about Sonata. And Sonata is a translation framework. So when you write a piece of computer software and it has to have prompts and stuff in whatever the native language is, you have to be able to translate in other languages so other people can use it that don't speak the language you do. And so there's a bunch of frameworks that are already in the software to do this, but then you have to actually get people involved and get the prompts to be changed. And this sort of makes it all handy because it's all sort of a web interface and that sort of thing. Have you looked at Sonata at all, Simon?
No, this was the first time I'd heard about it when I got the rundown from you for the show. I took a quick look. It looks like it's pretty niche. It's got a fairly small development team. So I'm going to be interested to hear from them about the project and what its relationship is to Poodle, which is the tool that I'm familiar with for doing translations.
Yeah. And it's too bad because last week was supposed to be Poodle, which we could have then compared because it's also in a similar space. So we could have compared the two, but that's okay. We'll get Poodle back on and they'll... And they'll get to compare against Sonata now because now we've done that first. So I think what I'm going to say is, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guest, David Mason. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I've been listening for a while.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking from Brisbane in Australia at about 2:30 in the morning.
Wow, thanks for staying up late or getting up early or whatever you had to do to be on the show then. And I also noticed that that's probably going to be a little tiny bit of Skype delay, so I'll try not to step on your answers or step on your questions or whatever. So we'll see if we can get that to work. So at the beginning of the show, I gave a bit of an overview of what I could quickly discern in about a half hour of research what Sonata is about. Would you please give us the 30,000-foot view and tell us what problem it's solving?
Okay. Well, the basic problem that it's solving is that translators want to translate text. And so what they really deal with is getting pieces of text in one language and converting that into another language. And ideally, that's all that they should have to deal with. or if they're technical translators, then that and the technical domain in which they're translating. And essentially the concept of Zenata is that it allows the people who are producing the strings to just put them out there in a space where translators can access them, and then the translators can basically work in an environment that just gives them what they want, which is the strings, some information about similar strings, that's pretty much the nuts and bolts of it.
Not the nuts and bolts. Now, by translation, you're talking about the strings that are used in prompts and other interfaces for programs, right?
Yeah, well, we have two main types of translation that are that Zenata is used for at the moment, which is software translation, which would be things like command prompts, UI elements, and things like that, but also documentation. There's also a fair bit of documentation work that's translated, so that's taking a document, usually in an XML format, that's sort of broken into paragraphs, and then those are translated.
Okay, and how did Zenata come about?
It started in 2008. Asgeir was working at Red Hat at the time, and traditionally translation work has been done with a few formats, and the get text format, which is PO files, was used and has been quite popular. And initially Zenata was just a way to parse a PO file, put it into a simple editor that allowed users or the translators to see the source string, enter their translated string, and then it would generate the translated version of the PO file out of that. It's come a long way since then, but that was sort of where it began.
What's the interface that I'm using? You said something about getText. Can you describe a little more about what getText does? As a programmer, what am I writing in my program to say, please put the appropriate string for the prompt here?
Okay, so getText is available in most programming languages. And the basic idea is that rather than put a literal string directly into your program, let's say you have a prompt that's going to ask you how many hats you want. And so you'll have some text that says, how many hats would you like? And generally, getText is aliased to just use an underscore, so the getText function will be sort of less intrusive. And so you'll end up with something that's along the lines of underscore and then parentheses containing that string. So essentially you add three characters around that literal string. So that's the first part of it, where you set your strings up for translation or for extraction, ready for translation. And then you can run a getText utility such as xgetText, and that will extract those strings. So it'll basically look through the source. It'll find all the references to the getText function, pull those strings out into what's called a POT file, which is a PO template file. Mm-hmm. And that is a fairly simple format. It has some headers to describe various metadata. And then each entry just has some comments, which can include things like source comments about how things should be translated, some context information. If you're dealing with multiple files, it can pull them into a single POT file. And then it'll have the message ID, which is just the extracted string, and then it'll have an empty message string, which is sort of a placeholder for where the translation will go. And you can basically take that POT file, copy it, change a few things in there, and then sort of, you know, rename it and manually enter your translations for your language of choice into it. So that's the extraction side of things. And then I think I'm going on a bit, so I'll just briefly go on the other side of things. That basically, once the translator has filled in all of the translations, sent the file back to you, it can be committed into source control, but then it's essentially compiled into a MO file, which is then sort of part of the compiled application that will allow switching of locales, and then that represents the resource that contains those strings.
Okay, so like I'm starting with, obviously I'm going to be programming in English as my native language, so I would go ahead and write my application as if it's going to be just magically all in English. And then I put these little underscore things around there, and then I extract the stuff into the, I think it's called a PO file or whatever. Now, where does Zenata come in play then? Do I take these PO files and put them into Zenata somewhere so that people can look at them and translate them to other languages?
Sort of, except there's a little bit more of abstraction there. So one of the big problems with getting a PO file and then emailing it out to all of your various translators, like Red Hat Enterprise Linux is available in 22 languages at GA, so you've got at least 22 teams that you're sending your strings to. Mm-hmm. And that'll very quickly become a very complicated logistical operation, getting everything distributed, collecting it back, chasing up various teams. So basically what would happen if you use Zenata as a developer, you will extract your strings into your POT file as normal, and then you'll have a Zenata configuration file in your project directory, and run one of the a command from one of the Zenata clients, and there are a few available, and that will essentially look through that POT file, look at all the strings in there, extract them, and send those off to the Zenata server. And then on the server, translators see those strings as, or see those POT files just as generic documents. So they don't really need to know that it came from a POT file. It could come from a Java properties file, could come from an XLIF file, and more recently, it could come from plain text or any of the open document formats, or a Mozilla DTD file, various formats, and then but that's not really, that's just an implementation detail really, and something that translators mm-hmm. shouldn't need to worry about, and so they essentially, as far as they're concerned, are working with generic documents. There are some complications with sort of character escaping and things like that, where you sort of can't completely abstract all of that out, but in general it tends to work quite well.
And so now once you've gotten into Zenata, then I, as a person speaking a different language, not me, but somebody else, I guess, would see the English strings that I, the programmer, had created, and some context for it, or I'm just looking just at the strings. I mean, how do we communicate that this is meant to be the command prompt for something, for example?
Well, the most important context is the surrounding strings, and so we make sure that our editor displays strings in the order that we get them, which is that's especially important for documentation. So let me see. There's that, and then usually the context in a PO file or a POT file is it has a special type of comment which gives the context, and so that is presented in the editor. Beyond that, it can be quite difficult to sort of, particularly for a compiled application. I don't think any tool is capable, at least to my knowledge, of compiling an application and showing the sort of the UI with the strings in directly to a translator. There are a few things I've done recently for some formats that'll let you do that. Sort of, if you've got an open document text document, you can get a preview of that with the strings that you've entered. But translators are used to working with software translation strings that they sort of can't see the UI that it's presented in, and that's kind of something you have to go and check after you've done your preliminary translations per project.
I'm interested, actually, what the relationship is between this and Pootle. I've seen within several of the projects that I've taken an interest in that they're using Pootle as their translation server. Is there some relationship between what you're doing here and Pootle? It sounds like you've got files that have got a related suffix, and they're either about cannabis or about something else. What are those POT files?
There is a very strong relationship. Not a communicative relationship. Pootle and Zenata do very, very similar things. And as they evolve, they because they're covering this a similar problem domain, they seem to be drifting closer together in the features that they provide. So as far as the main difference between Pootle and Zenata, I haven't got a whole lot of recent experience with Pootle. And I was looking forward to the podcast schedule for last week with them, but I'll have to wait for that one. But the main difference between the two is that ours is, Zenata's written in Java, and Pootle is, I believe, Python-based. Other than that, just recently looking at the sort of features they've got, a lot of them have a lot of what they seem to have done more recently is overlapping with a lot of our features, which means it'll be interesting to see what happens there with the two projects. There's definitely a lot of room for a lot of back and forth there.
Right. I mean, the reputation that Pootle has is for being very complicated to configure and install. How simple is your code to get set up on a new project?
Now, there are a few different options there. The simplest option is if you've got an open source project, then there's a central instance of Zenata, which is at zenata.org. You can basically just... So you don't need to install anything. You can basically just sign up to that instance and then push a project. So you create a project through the UI, create a version for that, and then you'll need to download a client, although that's not completely necessary these days. Then you can push your strings in there, and then it's there, set up, and sort of away you go. If you wanted to sort of be a bit more secretive about it, then you can set up your own Zenata instance. One of our team members has made a downloadable package which basically gives you Zenata along with the application server, which is JBoss, on which it runs. And that's all basically ready to go. All you have to do is create the database for it and fire it up.
Right. So I'm known on Floss Weekly for asking questions about governance. So taking a look at your project homepage, it looked like Red Hat had a really strong influence on this project. What is the relationship of the project to Red Hat?
Basically, at the moment, the vast majority of the development work on the project is through Red Hat. The core development team are all employees of Red Hat, and we're all now all based in the same office. We did have another team member who was in China, which made for some slightly more complicated communication. Basically, at the moment, we are steering the way that the project goes because we're basically writing all of the code, and a lot of the I'd say the majority of the users at this stage are Red Hat translators who are translating Fedora, so various Fedora applications, as well as our own Enterprise Linux applications.
Right. So going forward into the future, do you expect this project to be more broad-based? Are you expecting there to be other contributors coming in, or are you pretty happy having this largely a Red Hat-only project?
We're definitely keen to have contributions from as many other people as possible. There are a few barriers to that at the moment, which are largely to do with the complexity of the code base, because it's a fairly large project. It can. I definitely remember when I started working on it, there was quite a learning curve there, which sort of doesn't encourage sort of your sort of basement dabbler to necessarily go through the effort to learn what's where to be able to actually sort of get to making a useful contribution. And that's something that I've been working on and that we've had in mind. It's sort of a balance between the time I need to spend writing code to implement features that we need versus sort of improving documentation and various other things to try and make the project more accessible to external contributions. I think that's something that will come more with maturity of the project. Over time, the code base becomes sort of cleaner, better organized, more intuitive, and the setup processes for development get better and better documented. And I think that's something that'll mainly just take time. It'll take effort over that time, but it's not something that we could fix overnight, I think.
Right. I see you're using CloudBees to do the build and test. How's that working out for you?
Mixed results. The main use of CloudBees at the moment is for their Maven repository that they provide. We've moved most of our continuous integration builds to internal servers, largely because of the limits that CloudBees place on sort of a number of build hours and that kind of thing, which sort of didn't fit with what we wanted to do. We have we tend to have quite a lot of builds running quite frequently to sort of make sure that everything's always in a not very broken state.
Right.
Actually, I've recently also the Okapi project, which is a slightly related project. They've moved their builds to... they moved to CloudBees? They've had a few issues with CloudBees that I've helped them sort through just to do with getting things set up. But they've been hitting the same sort of problems that we were, just with the build limits, which I think it's to be expected unless you want to pay them money.
So I see you're using GitHub. That's usually a sign that you've got a pull request style of governance where there's no formal rules about who gets commit rights. It's all up to your master committers, of whom Olo seems to suggest you have about 5 people who are actively involved in the project. Do you have a more formal view of your governance with formal membership and formal rules about who can commit? Or are you just sticking to that very relaxed GitHub pull request and we'll see if we like it approach?
To be honest, that hasn't really come up because the commits that we have are all from the core development team, and generally most of the hang on, let me think about the external you know, sort of, if we were receiving pull requests frequently, then that would be something to consider. And we certainly would welcome any commits. It's just something that there aren't many. I don't want to say there aren't any because I have to remember whether. I know there have been a few bits and pieces of contributions, but certainly nothing frequent. And a lot of those from people who have worked on the project in the past. So basically just as a result of the fact that all the commits are coming from the core development team, it hasn't been necessary to consider what to do with commits from outside the development team. But essentially, if they, if someone did have a pull request, we would be more than happy to review the code and include it.
So earlier you mentioned the Okapi framework. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that's the Okapi framework is addressing a different problem in the localization and internationalization space. So it's about making automated pipelines which can sort of process documents, sort of run them through translation memories in preparation for human translation, and do various other things with those. And Okapi is how I sort of got in touch with the Zenata framework. So Asgeir, who started Zenata, was or still is a member of the development team for Okapi, and I made some contributions to Okapi in the past, and I haven't been as active there more recently, mainly just because of how busy I've been. But I try to keep up with what's going on and on with them. And there's certainly a lot of opportunity there for the Zenata framework the Zenata project to use code from that framework, which has happened recently. We've had a little bit of code of theirs for a while, but I've recently hooked it up so that I can use their code to enable translation of all of the open document formats and a few others. And the way that I've done it means that I'll be able to add more formats quite easily in the future.
And what attracted you initially to the Okapi and the, now the Zenata framework? What's your background that might overlap with that?
It was sort of a bit of an accident. I've been interested in open source development for quite a long time, at least 15 years. But it's something that I sort of never got around to. I was young and did all sorts of things that don't really make sense now that I look back at it. I was going to think I was going to be a blacksmith at one point. I completed a vet degree, so I'm a qualified veterinarian. various other things. But I always found, during my vet degree, I was living with someone who was doing a game development degree, and I found half the time I'd be down the hall looking over his shoulder at what he was doing, and sort of finding that very interesting. And eventually I just had to admit to myself that what I really wanted to be doing was writing code. And so I went and started doing that. And it was during my studies, I ended up with an assignment, and one of the options, there was sort of some standard options, and then there was an interesting option, which was do work on an open source project, and the subject was a localization one. So I talked to my lecturer, and he put me in contact with the Okapi guys, and sort of found some work that I could do that was suitable for the assessment, and then sort of just stuck with it after that.
So you started as a code contributor to the open source project, or did you also help with translations? I understand you speak multiple languages.
I speak some words in multiple languages. I'm interested in learning languages, but I think I can say that I don't speak about five or six different languages in those languages.
How many languages can you order a beer in? This is the most important question.
Ooh. Maybe five. Definitely three. I spent a bit of time in China.
Makes you an essential traveling companion, and you know you want to check it, you want to scope out Randall a little bit here because he needs that sort of help when he's out cruising.
Yes,
that is on cruises, not cruising on the streets, which of course
Randall, a whole different thing, right? Yes. So how did you train yourself to be a programmer? Or did you actually take formal classes for that?
Yes, I did. I didn't begin with formal classes. Actually, some years ago, I guess it would be about. While I was at school, which was getting towards 15 years ago, makes me feel a bit old. I loved all the programming classes I did back at school, and I was actually I decided to be a programmer back then, but I'm not sure what happened. But I sort of ended up on a different path. But and there was actually a game. Sort of a British-made one called Creatures, which was just about having little, cute little things and teaching them to speak and using reward and punishment to train them to, you know, to eat so they don't starve to death and various things like that. And that was actually sort of my introduction to programming, was making objects for the world in which they lived. So I played around a lot with that back then, which was interesting because it meant that I was starting from a very object-oriented place. And so it's odd to me now when people have trouble understanding sort of moving from procedural to object-oriented programming, because it's just because I had that beginning. And then in the intervening time, I basically sort of played around with a bunch of web stuff, and sort of taught myself PHP, taught myself JavaScript, taught myself C#, taught myself Java, and sort of tinkered with those. But when I decided to do it as a career, I took on a master's and did that, which was really valuable, basically just to mainly for the tools that it showed me were out there, and a lot of the software patterns and things that you don't get if you just learn how to write code. It's sort of only a small bit of it. Must have worked. I got much higher marks in that than I did in my vet degree by the end of it anyway.
I was just going to ask. What's the? Because I don't often get a chance to ask this of anyone. What's the biggest difference between being a programmer and being a veterinarian?
The biggest difference for me is that as a veterinarian, you generally start with something that is below average, and the best that you can possibly do. And this is in the 10% of cases where what you do actually makes a difference, is bring them back up to average. So you take an animal that's sick and you make them not sick anymore. Whereas in programming, you basically start with something that either doesn't exist or might be average and improve it and keep on improving on it and make something better and better, and you make something that's never existed before. So basically it's the difference between generally a fixing and sort of investigative and fixing approach versus a creative approach. So that for me is the biggest difference. There are a lot of other differences that led to the change in career, sort of to do with working conditions, and a lot of that's sort of specific to the industry in Australia, attitudes and things like that. But at the end of the day, it boiled down to I want to be creating something, and if I'm not doing that, then I'm not really happy.
And also, I should ask you this too, were you a small animal vet or a big animal vet?
I was aiming for a small animal surgical sort of direction, so I probably would have gone to North America and studied in that if I'd stuck with it, basically because general practice, although it's based on very interesting science, which I loved while I was learning it, can tend to get quite repetitive with sort of the common conditions being very common and often not requiring sort of a really thorough investigation. So you sort of have to make do with just treating the symptoms for a lot of things and only really take the expense to look into it if it doesn't sort of get fixed.
Yep. And probably with programming, I could probably guess that you get bit a little less often too, right?
A lot less often. definitely a lot less often. Get bitten a lot less kicks and scratches. So that's all positive.
That sounds like an uptick, definitely. Go ahead, Simon.
It all becomes virtual. You know, it's dealing with trolls and dealing with being bitten on mailing lists. I'm sure the internal attitude of the soul has to be the same.
Yeah. I guess when it boils down to it, that does apply.
Well, a couple more questions.
That usually can't kill you.
Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying that usually can't kill you. That was another big deterrent, was that you could just accidentally die, which is a lot less likely to happen with a computer. Yeah. Although still possible if you use your imagination.
So I just want to ask a couple more questions about Zenata as we can start to wrap up here. So what's the future for Zenata? How is it going to play out? I understand you're trying to get more contributors from the outside, maybe move it more towards a traditional open source model. But what's still missing on the roadmap for features?
We have, if we add it up, we have at least a couple of years worth of feature requests. So we sort of churn through those as quickly as we can and try and prioritize as best we can. I think I have a list here somewhere. I was thinking about this earlier and didn't want to miss too much. So at the moment we're working on performance and stability. As we get bigger, as we get more users and more projects, that's becoming more and more of a concern, something we want to make sure that isn't going to be slowing people down. And we'll also be looking at being able to move to bigger server architectures, things like sharding, that kind of thing. We've got a new client coming along that shouldn't be too different from the old one. But it will, that'll help us. I've got a student project that I supervised, which was a synchronization client that will, it needs a bit more work, and I'm aiming to get that done by early next year. That will let translators work on the desktop if they don't want to work in the web app, or if they need to go offline for some amount of time. That'll help keep everything synced with the server as quickly as possible without them having to worry about it. Because an issue with offline translation is you can have things getting out of sync between the translator's workspace and the central server. So that's something that I'm trying to push forward. We're aiming to do more community outreach. For me personally, that means documenting our development a lot more so that if someone does want to develop, they've got some stuff they can read through that'll help them be able to actually get in and start writing code. I'm also always on the lookout for interested students. So anyone in the Brisbane area, we are taking interns. What else? There are lots and lots and lots of sort of features that we're looking at adding, but I guess to mention a few, we're looking at user spaces, so that the idea is at the moment everything is every document fits within a project which is managed by the project maintainer, who would be the developer of a piece of software or the author of some documentation. This would allow a translator to have their own workspace where they can take a document that they need to translate that might not necessarily be in Zenata, and they can upload that, translate it with Zenata, and then download it again to help them be able to work in a consistent environment rather than have to switch to a different tool just because they're doing something different. And another big area we're looking at is improving the glossaries. So at the moment they're fairly straightforward, sort of here's a word, here's a definition, but there's a lot more that can be done with that to do with allowing editing and sort of comparison between different languages and things like that. And if I go on any longer, I'll go on all night. So
what we doing? Yeah, so earlier you said that I could install this by downloading it and installing it on my own system, but you had a hosted solution at Zenata.org, and I only had to register there and upload my project, my text files. Are there volunteer translators that would help me out in other languages, or do I also need to bring all the humans that I need to do something on Zenata.org?
Essentially, it comes down to there are translators who are working on Zenata.org. Many of them are employed by Red Hat at the moment, but there are others who are affiliated with the Fedora project. And basically, it'd boil down to letting them know that your project is there and getting them interested in translating it. That's another area that we can do more to sort of allow translators to discover new projects or projects, you know, if they just want to contribute some translations, get some practice or anything, then allow them to discover your project. I mean, it's on the main project list, but I'm sure there's more that we can do in that area. If you want to get it fully translated in sort of in a hurry, then definitely getting your own people to get on board and do that would be necessary. As is the case with anything in open source, you'll take what you can get from volunteers, but you really need to encourage people to contribute if you want to get a lot done.
Now, so you have people that are on Red Hat staff that do some of the translation, clearly for Red Hat projects. Do you have volunteers also working on Red Hat projects? And if so, are you missing any languages that you'd like people to step up for that might be listening to this show?
Let's see. I'm usually busy looking at the code and not not too closely at who's translating. But for our internal products, we have an internal instance that's used for that. A lot of what's on Zenata.org, it's usually not our internal projects, but more on the Fedora side of things. Definitely from seeing the user list and from handling requests for joining language teams, there are definitely users there who aren't using Red Hat email addresses. But I can't tell without investigating whether they might be Red Hat people who are just using their personal email address or their Fedora address to sort of in that context. Basically, it boils down to I don't have that information, but okay. I'm sure there are some, but I definitely can't give numbers.
That's fine. And so when you say internal projects, you're talking about RHEL and JBoss and things like that?
Yeah, things like that. And I've just got a message here from the product owner who is a translator who sort of makes the so it has the final say in what features are top priority at the time. She's noted that Sonata.org projects are open to all, and anyone can step up for any language of their choice. Even Klingon, apparently. Actually, yes, we do. I remember seeing that language code in there. So, there's definitely no restriction on who can translate. And I'm pretty sure there was some call for hiring translators, at least for the Brisbane office. If there are any translators out there who are in the Brisbane area and maybe looking for work, I saw something across my email about that. But yeah, as far as Sonata.org, if you know more than one language, then you can probably get involved.
Very cool, very cool. Well, we're just about out of time. I just wanted to ask you, is there anything that we didn't ask you that you'd like to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think I made a list for this as well.
Yes, there's a list you sent us. I think we covered everything there, so.
I figured by 3 a.m, I would have trouble remembering things, so. Oh, maybe I've lost it.
Hopefully not in more ways than one.
Anyway, what have we got? I mean, there's always the fallback of the two standard questions.
Yes. Need to ask the two standard questions. What's your favorite scripting language?
Now, for this one, I'm going to say Python. The main reason I'm not saying Perl is because I haven't used Perl. I've sort of done Hello World, and that's about as far as I've gotten. Uh-huh. I learned Python at the same time as trying to figure out how OLPC was structured, how the Sugar OS worked, which was interesting. But yeah, there are some things I like about Python.
Cool. Yeah, no problem. People like Python are fine with me. It's just, whatever works for everybody is whatever works for everybody. So also then, your favorite text editor of some kind?
If I'm choosing between Emacs and Vi, then it has to be Vi because I haven't used Emacs. I have a few others I use, but nothing that really stands out.
There we go. All right, good. Well, I appreciate you staying up until what is now 3:15 a.m. for you, because it's that's something I would rarely do just to be interviewed. But I appreciate you doing that, and hope you'll probably fall asleep real quickly after this, I can imagine. So thank you very much for joining the show.
You're most welcome. My pleasure.
Very good. That was David Mason, who has been a member of the Sonata's core development team for about the last 16 months and talked a lot about what Sonata does and also about what being a veterinarian is about. So, Simon, what do you think?
It's got these seeds of being an interesting project. Looking at it there, I'd say that – just stop my phone from ringing here. There we go.
Yes.
I'd say it's got the seeds of being an interesting project. I had a look at the OLO statistics for it, and there's really just a group of 5 people at Red Hat working on it. I think in order to get some legs and go someplace, it's got to find some more people, maybe from the audience today, to go take a look at it and find that it's interesting. I think that it looks like it fits in well into a continuous integration environment. Being a Java application, it's going to work well alongside a whole lot of other Java infrastructure. So I wish them well. I'm looking forward to seeing if they're able to grow their community and go some other place.
Yeah, and anything I think that you know helps out with this problem of just having language or just having, you know, given that we're an international community, especially in open source, you know, having some way to collaborate and cooperate instead of just emailing .po files around. This is definitely a step up from that. And yeah, you're right. I wish we could have got, you know, last week's cancellation was sort of unfortunate, but it would have been nice to also put the other project whose name I already forgot, Poodle, also against this. Yeah, to put that against this to see what that looked like. And I know Poodle's going to come back on soon. We just haven't put the date in yet. I think it's actually coming up first part of the January. But we'll get them back on and or on for the first time actually and do a nice comparison, A/B comparison with that. But you know, there's also the other thing that I think he referred to somewhere in the middle of the show, which is that that you know part of the reason it might not be catching on for outside contributors is because the code is just weird. You know, the code needs better documentation, better organization, and that's something I think to remember. I know that a lot of projects that might not necessarily know they're going to be open source at some point might take shortcuts in terms of development time and you know not do the right thing the first time inside the code base. And this is part of the cost of that. If you want to have more people contribute to it, it's got to be maintainable. And that's true even internally, but I think if you're only going to keep something internally, you tend not to think about worrying about that, because you know you know anybody that's going to work on the code, you can just walk down to the next cubicle over and say, well, how did that code work for you? But when you open source it, man, somebody could be halfway around the world that needs to, you know, make a change or patch or something without having good internal documentation, good organization, that's not really possible. So,
right. Yeah, the other thing that would be interesting to find out would be how translators actually get on with it, because I've watched the LibreOffice project setting up its translation environment, and it's actually interesting to see how translators have got their own way of working and their own social approach to dealing with translations. And I could imagine that without somebody to deal with all the technical complexity of the code, you might well discover that a group of people whose role in a project is translation rather than directly being responsible for core coding might find it too complex to take on and instantiate. So I think if they want to grow the project, they need to ask themselves some questions about that complexity and about the approachability of the project for translators.
Yeah, sounds like a good thing there. Well, let's go ahead and look at what we've got coming, since I mentioned that a moment ago. Next week, we have The Foreman, which manages a startup for provisioning hosts. I believe that's another Red Hat project, so I guess we've got another couple of Red Hat projects in a row. Broadleaf Commerce, which is going to be the week where you want to bring your Dilbert bingo card, because it's the fully customizable open source e-commerce framework designer. Okay. Buzzword, buzzword, buzzword. I love those. Okay. The following 2 weeks are web frameworks of various kinds. We have CakePHP, a very popular PHP framework. I don't know much about PHP, but I know it was originally written in Perl. It's the only thing I know about PHP, but apparently it's a very popular web framework called CakePHP. And then Yesod, I don't know how to pronounce that, but there we go. And that's a web framework written in Haskell, which is another language I've tried to learn 7 times, and each time I stop when they start using scholarly terms that are not in my background. We have we have no show for December 26th. The Twit Brick House is taking the week off, so I will also be taking the week off. And then we'll be right back first of the year. We're going to get Node.js back on. I know we had to cancel with that before because of the last-minute scheduling conflict, but Node.js has been rescheduled for the first show of the new year, January 2nd. So looking forward to all those upcoming shows. I'll be scheduling more shows for Q1. I've just opened up the dates for Q1. I'll be scheduling more shows for Q1 and let you know about them. If you follow us, if you go to the big spreadsheet at twit.tv/floss. You can see our upcoming shows. You can also follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+. I post things there regularly about what's going on in terms of new guests and upcoming guests. You can also follow Floss Weekly on both Identica and Twitter. I occasionally post messages there as well. We have a live chat that goes along with each show. We're at live.twit.tv. We tape the show at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, which is what time it is right now here. Unfortunately, that was 2:30 in the morning in Brisbane. So sorry for that, Mr. David there. My birthday is tomorrow. We're taping this the day before Thanksgiving, so I turn 51 tomorrow, the big age there, and I'm actually flying from LAX to PDX, getting up for a 6:05 a.m. flight, just so I can be with my family and friends for my birthday and for Thanksgiving. So the things I do to get around. You can follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I'm also on Google+, as Randall L. Schwartz. Been posting a lot of really clever and interesting things there every day, so that's the enjoyable part of that. I think that's everything I want to plug for now. Simon, what do you want to say?
Oh, I was just going to compliment you on how you're looking slim and healthy, actually, there, Randall.
Oh, yeah.
Today you're down to 188 pounds, according to Twitter.
Indeed, yeah. I've gone from 215 to 188 in the last 13 weeks.
Right, and you know you're looking slim and healthy. I have to tell you, just on
that's a camera effect.
I thought it was a camera effect, but it's not. It's actually for real up there. So yes, congratulations on that, and keep it up. You're very. It's very inspiring following you on Twitter.
Thank you.
So for me coming up, I've got a visit over to Malaysia next week. If you're going to the Malaysian Government Open Source Conference, I'm giving the keynote on day two. That's the 27th of November. And then after that, I'm home. And you can just follow my stuff by going to webmink.com. That's the URL on the screen if you're watching video. And from there, you'll find links to my column in InfoWorld every Friday and in Computer World occasionally in the UK. Coming up in the spring, if you are somebody who goes to FOSDEM in Brussels, FOSDEM is on the 2nd and 3rd of February in 2013. And the call for papers for all the DevRooms is open at the moment. So you need to go right now to go look at the DevRoom schedule and get your paper submissions in so that I can see you in FOSDEM in Brussels in the first weekend in February in 2013. Apart from that, I'd like to wish all of my American friends a very happy Thanksgiving. The rest of the world is very thankful for the reduction in the amount of email that we'll be getting on Thursday and Friday. So thank you for that.
Indeed, indeed. And thank you, Simon, for crawling out of your, not I was going to say deathbed, but no, your sick bed.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, because I know at the last minute, since I couldn't find a co-host that would replace you after you sent me the email, I'm glad that you were able to step up anyway, and I appreciate it very much.
I'm going to go crawl into bed now. So.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. We've done the job. We can get out of here. We're on our way out. All right, Simon, thanks a lot, and we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.